You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
This episode of Social Europe Podcast is brought to you by the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford. Maximize your effectiveness in the changing global business environment with a postgraduate Oxford Diploma in Global Business. Taught in four short modules over a year, the program is designed to accelerate your career and increase your impact while minimizing the disruption to your work and family life. Learn alongside senior executives from around the world and develop a lifelong network. Visit the Oxford Diploma in Global Business website to find out more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Social Europe Podcast. My name is Robin Wilson. I'm the acting editor-in-chief of Social Europe. Our guest today is Mary Daly, professor of sociology and social policy at the University of Oxford and author of Gender Inequality and Welfare States in Europe, recently published by Edward Elgar. I hope you enjoy the discussion. Hello, Mary, and welcome to you.
Robin, it's a pleasure.
Obviously, in writing a book like this, you are highlighting how the literature on the welfare state has often been, in your assessment, gender blind. What have been the key blind spots?
A good question. I think the first blind spot has been in what is studied of the welfare state, or what it is about the welfare state that is studied. And most of the literature has studied social insurance benefits, so unemployment payments, pensions, accident and illness payments. And these are, of course, important, but they're classically men's benefits, and they're actually only a part of the welfare state. So what hasn't been in the literature as much as it should be is what we call social assistance benefits, that is, benefits that are kind of discretionary. So people have to have a need of some kind and have that need kind of legitimized by the statutory authorities to get these benefits. And they're primarily women. It's primarily women who have historically anyway used those benefits. And another thing that has been less studied generally in welfare states that's important from a gender perspective is social services. So most of our literature on the welfare state comes from studying income support, how the welfare state guarantees income support. We have far less literature on how the welfare state provides services and indeed how the welfare state is an employer. And this kind of emphasis on social insurance, what's called kind of men's welfare state, has meant that we know most about the welfare state as a kind of a settlement between social classes, in particular between workers, organized workers through trade unions, for example, or perhaps through political parties, and employers. So that's kind of the kind of literature has sought to understand and explain the welfare state in terms of the ways it tries to manage this conflict. And of course, that overlooks the fact that the welfare state is also very much engaged in managing relations between women and men and between generations, and indeed between the family and society, or the family and the state, or the family and the market. So there's a number of blind spots, but they seem to me the most important.
Okay, Mary, now you said there that the welfare state has been to some degree about managing relations between women and men. And you do say in your book that there have been some changes in the welfare state which have addressed gender concerns, but you say they tend to have been confined to labour market participation by women. So what do you think has been lacking in that regard?
I think if you take a lot, it depends on the kind of the length of history you look at. And historically, I think certainly from the kind of 1970s, 1980s on, the welfare state or particular welfare states, the European Union, for example, did problematize gender inequality or women's disadvantage relative to men. So it was part of a project. Gender inequality was part of a bigger project for a certain period of time. But over the last 20 years, it's the gender equality dimension of the welfare state has come to focus more and more on employment, and in particular, to increase the numbers of women in employment. And while having everyone in employment is important, it's not a solution to gender inequality. And what has happened, I think, is that, you know, women's lives have become more like men, and men really haven't been required to change, or the institutions around male lives have not been required to change in the way that women have been required to change. And you can see this in the indicators. So we now measure gender equality primarily by wage gaps. And we know those wage gaps tell us, or that wage gap data tells us, there's, you know, depending on the country you look at, between a 15% to 20% wage gap between women and men in general. But that gap in itself is much too narrow, I think, as a measure of gender inequality. Employment is important, but it's not the only thing. We need to think about power. We need to think about women's access to decision making at whatever level, you know, we're looking at, whether it's in the workplace or whether it's in the home or whether it's in the kind of public institutions like parliaments or local councils or whatever. So power is one dimension that we haven't really focused on sufficiently. And another is time. And in my book, I say there are really three things that we need to be measuring equality around through the lens of the welfare state. One is employment. The second is income, and not just income from employment, but income from all sources, the welfare state, from wealth, from whatever. And the third one is time. How much time do people have available to them? How much choice do they have around using the time they have? And in particular, the time distribution between women and men, not just in the paid labor market, but also in the home.
Yes, that issue of time that you've raised, Mary, does bring in the distinction you highlight in the book between public and private, and how that is taken for granted. And that leads to a disproportionate share, still very disproportionate share, of care work for women, as you've said in talking about the double burden that employed women typically face. How can we encourage a rethinking of that public-private distinction so that women's choices aren't so constrained?
Well, I think we've probably started that actually already. I mean, in the last 10 years or so, we've seen this kind of work-family reconciliation perspective, or work-family balance, which has concerned itself with and not just the amount of hours that people work and are paid for in the paid economy, but also to some extent that people shouldn't be overburdened in the private domain. And you've seen a growth of leave from employment, for example, for family-related purposes. We've always had maternity leave, but increasingly we've had paternity leaves and parental leaves. So they're a step, I think, in that direction of kind of recognizing that equality doesn't stop in the public domain. You also need to intervene in the private domain. And that's, I think, one first step in that. But, you know, it's interesting in COVID, I think, and I know we'll come on to talk about COVID, but it seems to me when I look at the measures that have been taken around COVID, I'm very struck by this public-private domain again, that's been quite prominent, because what most governments did was lock down. So they locked down people in basically into their own homes. So the whole, and they put nothing, hardly anything in place to support people in their own homes The services were all cut, for example. And the welfare state intervened in the kind of what you might think of the public domain around supporting employment, trying to keep jobs going through furlough schemes and so forth, and also through some income support measures. But the things that we had put in place around private life and kind of trying to ensure that private life or so-called private life functioned well, they've actually more or less stopped. So that's kind of interesting. And feminists historically have kind of developed this idea of a public-private divide as one of the institutions, if I could use that word, that actually kept inequality, gender inequality particularly, going.
Yes, and some evidence, Mary, in terms of what you're saying, that the coronavirus crisis has exacerbated existing trends around that public-private divide, because it has meant that women have been doing additional hours of caring work, and while men have been doing some more additional hours, they haven't been adapting nearly as much to the crisis as women have. And of course, there's also been the extreme scenario of women exposed to domestic violence and so on a greater scale. So is your sense of it at this early stage that the coronavirus crisis has perhaps had been less of a shock to the system in terms of gender roles than it might have been?
Yeah, it's a good question, one that bears thinking about. And of course, we haven't got enough research yet to know, but a shock is always an interesting experience, I think, because it is an opportunity to change on the one hand, but it also reveals the fundamentals of the system on the other. And my sense is that coronavirus has revealed in some ways how shallow our edifice or our architecture for gender equality is, particularly in the last 10 years, because what we've kind of based gender inequality or gender equality on is women being able to move into employment and an architecture of childcare services to support that. And sometimes those childcare services are dependent on low-income, low-paid jobs and migrant workers, particularly when we think of also for elder care. Now, coronavirus has stopped all of that. And so what we see when we look at who's caring for the children and who's caring for the older people, it is in the first instance family-based. So we have a return to family, which was something that we tried to, you know, change when we moved towards gender equality. And also within families, the evidence suggests that it is women, as you say, who have borne the main burden of childcare. So the statistics that I see for the UK suggest that really, on average, around childcare, families have about 40 hours during the height of lockdown. This is now had about 40 hours more childcare to undertake. And that of that, women did about three quarters of that. It depended a bit on whether men were home-based or not, and indeed whether women were home-based or not. So there's some variation there, and we need to be really careful about how we understand it. And as I said, I don't think we have yet got the evidence to really be clear about it. But in general, I think it's kind of reverted to the old pattern of women having the primary responsibility for childcare and men having a kind of a secondary responsibility in that regard.
Now, you've said already, Mary, that you think we need to understand that private-public divide from a gender perspective to really engage in any critique of the welfare state as it's developed. But when it comes to developing an alternative perspective, what you seem to be suggesting is that rather than focusing on labour market risks implicitly to men, the starting point should be the idea of the care economy. Now, can you explain what implications that change of perspective would have, including both for the socialization and sharing of domestic care, as well as for those women, mainly they are women, as you've said, working in paid care roles, often in precarious contexts?
Yeah, I mean, the care economy is a particular concept and developed by feminist economists in the main. And we need to pay attention to the economy aspect of it. I mean, there is a whole other literature that just generally talks more about care as a social value, as a way of relating to each other. And so we need to kind of understand that the care economy is nested, I think, within that broader sense that care matters. So if we start with the care economy concept, the sense of it is that we would value the work that goes into caring, paid caring, but also unpaid caring, but paid caring for those who need care in our societies, children, but also vulnerable adults, for example, and of course, older, fragile adults, that we would actually value that. And we would see it as a sector of the economy that has value and that should have good conditions of work. And certainly in the liberal, what are so-called the liberal welfare states,
that countries work like the UK, for instance.
UK, US, for example, to some extent Australia and so forth, that work tends to be low paid, very little conditions around people needed to be trained for it, but also generally kind of ignored as a kind of a poor sector of the economy. Now, that isn't in other countries like the Scandinavian countries, the continental European countries, for example. People have a high level of training for that work, and they have to, you know, go formally and train for it. And it's not considered a low paid sector. I mean, it's probably undervalued in many countries, but it's not quite undervalued to the extent that it is in the UK and the liberal economies. So we will have to think of the care economy and care as a sector of value. We will have to overturn the conditions and reward people better for it. And some countries did that. For example, France increased the payment rates or salaries of care workers during the pandemic. Scotland also tended to increase or bring forward, I think, a pay raise for that sector of the economy. So COVID was really an opportunity to actually treat these workers better. And I don't think it's an opportunity that has been taken. So resource the care economy much better, but also in terms of care as a broader value, as a kind of a moral value in society. We had some examples during early days of lockdown when people really started to care about each other and to care about the people in their local neighborhoods, for example, who might be living alone, who might have needs that couldn't be met because of service cutbacks and so forth. So there was some evidence there of a, you know, change or a kind of a return to the interpersonal values. Is my neighbor okay? Is my neighborhood okay? Are my family okay? And that, you know, feminists would say that, our care ethicists would say that that's actually a way towards a better society generally, and that, you know, COVID was an opportunity, is still an opportunity to return to that kind of making us care more about each other, making us care more about our environment, for example. And it's interesting in the newspapers today in Britain, there's this sense that the government is calling on people to actually report their neighbours if they break lockdown and so forth. And I wonder if that's a further movement away from caring, actually, that it's a very different perspective to actually caring about what's happening next door and trying to understand what's happening next door rather than running to kind of police your neighbours and so forth.
Well, one of the things that's been very striking about the coronavirus crisis, Mary, are the data showing the huge difference that it's made having female political leaders. Several times as many deaths have taken place per head in countries with male leaders as with female leaders, like in New Zealand. You did talk earlier about the importance of power in this, and it does seem to make a big difference at the highest level.
It's a, I've seen that as well. I'm a bit careful about that generalization. I'm thinking of countries, which countries it applies, certainly to New Zealand and to Germany, I think, are the two countries that I've seen it referred to. Perhaps there are others and I'm not recalling them now. But I think it's a bit more complicated than whether it's a woman is in charge or not. I think the welfare state is really important in all of it and how the welfare state is used, I mean, as a kind of a protective system. And that's the classic function of the welfare state, to protect against risks. It was never designed to protect against the kind of risk posed by, or the scale of the risk posed by coronavirus. So I think it's a bit more complicated than just whether it's a woman in charge or not.
But it does seem to be interesting that with the exception of Sweden, the Nordic welfare states certainly seem to have performed much better.
Yeah, they do seem to have performed much better, and it looks like their economies will recover quickly, more quickly as well. But I think with the Nordic welfare states, they're quite different. Like Sweden is an exception. Finland seems to me the one that has really performed the best from what I see of the statistics. And it's also one of the countries that's actually, I think, on the green list. I noticed that Denmark has gone back on the red list of visitors to the UK. So its rates are climbing. But I think those countries have protected vulnerable sectors of the population better. So they haven't had the kind of rampage that we've had in the UK and the US has had, and Canada indeed has had, through care homes of killing older people in large numbers. They haven't had that, which is really good, I think, and is a measure of the point I was making earlier about valuing care and valuing those who need it and valuing those who provide it, paying them properly, having good conditions, having good monitoring in care homes or indeed in people's own homes should they need care. So there are interesting differences there, I think, that we're just beginning to learn about, you know. So the kind of media attention has been on the gender of the leader, but I think it's much more profound than that. And it's about the nature of the economy and the nature of the welfare state in particular, and also, I suppose, public values about what matters.
So you seem to be saying, Mary, that we need to think about a welfare society as well as a welfare state, where certain values and forms of behavior just become spontaneous in a more solidaristic, less selfish kind of way. How do you think those values are best stimulated in society in a way that obviously isn't authoritarian or overly punitive?
Well, I mean, I start with the welfare state, really, because the welfare state is the best institution we have of solidarity. I mean, that's its origin, and it developed in different ways in different countries and has different nuances. But it is in almost every country, particularly if you include health system in it, the education system in it, housing, etc. It is the institution we have that is, I think, most oriented to social solidarity. And the welfare states received a really bad press in many countries as kind of neoliberalist thinking has taken forth. And as I said, the kind of emphasis on the market, the welfare state has existed, or is the rationale for it over the last 10 years in times of austerity, trying to recover from the recession of 2008. The welfare state's role has primarily been to shepherd people or push people in some countries or in some cases into employment. So it's, you know, this social investment perspective, which is bigger than just pushing people into employment, it must be said, because it's also about childcare and so forth, investing in the youngest generation. But generally, the kind of welfare state function has been to be a handmaiden to the labor market, to enable people to be self-supporting in the labor market. Now, it's interesting to think in the context of COVID whether that kind of welfare state is sustainable. And it doesn't seem to me that it is, because it depends on where people were pushed or where benefit recipients were pushed generally into was low-paying part-time jobs, which for many people required another earner. You needed to have households that are dual earning. And in fact, one person in that household needed to have a full-time job. So it comes back a little bit to the shallowness of the kind of recent settlement that we've had. And going forward, that doesn't seem to me to be, it's not clear we'll get those low-paying jobs back. And it's not clear we should want to get them back, that perhaps we need to think differently about a welfare state that's much more about equality, that's much more problem. It's, you know, so not about cheap solutions in a way, put everybody into employment, but much more about problem. Well, what is the problem of gender inequality, or be a Black and ethnic minority inequality, or inequalities as intersecting? What is that problem? Where does it start? And, you know, to have a sense that we actually try to understand that rather than just see it as a kind of an outcome related measure.
Okay, Maria, if we can come back then to finally to where we started with the conventional understanding of the welfare state as about dealing with implicitly male risks in the labour market. What you seem to be talking about is a kind of renewal or refoundation of the welfare state on the principle of rights, and rights defined in a very broad range of ways, including not just rights of individuals as conventionally assumed breadwinner workers, but also obviously rights of women, rights of members of ethnic minorities and other vulnerable individuals. How do you think that it's possible to change the political debate about welfare in the way that, for example, in Sweden was done with the phrase, the people's home, when suddenly people thought about what welfare was in a different way? How can that discourse about welfare be changed away from the neoliberal one that you mentioned, where it's just seen as a burden and a distraction, to something that's embraced more positively as a route to universal well-being?
That's a difficult question, particularly in such divided political times as we have, where people who are often most deprived of rights move towards populist parties and so forth. I mean, I like the concept of social protection generally, and that's an old concept. It's one of the kind of fundamental principles of welfare states. And the idea in it is there's an idea of rights, and you know, rights probably have been damaged during the coronavirus crisis. I'm thinking here, for example, of some of the legislation that was brought in with the lockdown in March, and that said that, you know, people who needed care and that the local authorities should only provide care or need only provide care for those who don't have it if it breaches their human rights. And that's a huge step back from the previous legislation, which said that local authorities had an obligation, full stop, to provide care for those who need it. So there has been, I think, we've had no new rights, really, that I can think of in COVID. And that's interesting to think about. So we could start a conversation around rights, and we could start a conversation around social protection and the kind of renewal of the welfare state, given that we live in a very different world to what we lived in. But I want to say that I think risks also have to be part of that conversation. because social protection historically is about protecting against risks. And yes, the way we conceived of the risks historically was male risks around labor market, not being able to work and men not being able to earn a so-called family wage. But COVID brings in all new kinds of risks, for example. We've talked about some of them, or I've talked about some of them, the fact that those jobs, those low-paying part-time work risks, particularly in the service economy, won't be available. So if they're not available, how do we enable people to earn an income? Should we think about universal basic income in that regard, for example? But also risks around people not being able to access care. We know that the health systems have been fully occupied, more than fully occupied, to deal with the health problems associated with COVID. And they've had priority in most countries. And that means that other health-related risks and care, kind of what we might think of as low-grade care, which doesn't require medical intervention, care for people, older people, for example, care for those who are ill, care for children. Though there have been huge gaps developed in that sphere, so we have to also think about really how we're going to respond to those needs. So I don't have a magic bullet for this, Robin, but I just think it's really important to recognize that the policies adopted in COVID were a choice and to critique them for the kind of choice they were. And did they attend to rights sufficiently? What kind of risks did they cover? And how could they have been better? And how can we be better going forward?
Which is a very good point which to leave it, Mary. And I'd like to thank you. That's Mary Daly, Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at the University of Oxford and author of Gender Inequality and Welfare States in Europe. Many thanks, Mary, for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.